On this week's 51%, we hear from an author whose book explores Martha Graham's international political life as she and her dance company promoted the United States in more than 30 nations for every presidential administration from Franklin D. Roosevelt through George H.W. Bush.
My sense is that her legacy is that of a revolutionary genius, someone who could look at human movement and distill something very distinct out of it that will move an audience.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Book Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy, Cold War historian Victoria Phillips illuminates the dance icon's four-decade reign as the country's premier cultural ambassador. Graham toured on behalf of every seated American president from Dwight Eisenhower to Ronald Reagan. Phillips, a one-time student of Graham's, reveals her mentor to be a master at using modern dance as a propaganda tool, promoting American values around the globe. Phillips begins by talking about why she wrote the book.
Allison, the reason that I began writing the book actually goes back to my first childhood experience of wanting a career, which was that I saw Martha Graham on stage and I saw her work Diversion of Angels when I was 16, and I thought, I want to do that. She was extraordinary. Her dancers were beautiful. The work summed up for me the abstraction of love, its passion in red, its joy in yellow, its purity represented by the woman in white. So I had an immediate fascination for Martha Graham and the world of modern dance, and began studying with her basically the next day, and I was lucky enough to be brought up in New York and to be able to go to her studio in the late 1970s. So I had a fascination with Graham that I became a very good waitress, as the saying goes, and ended up in the profession of history and became fascinated by Graham again.
You know, let's talk about her choreography. And, you know, what it said about American values that State Department officials were hoping to export.
The most important piece of, I would say, propaganda that Martha Graham brought with her was the pro-American work, such as Appalachian Spring with the Pulitzer Prize-winning score by Aaron Copland, originally known as Ballet for Martha. It's the story of the American frontier told with archetypes: the bride, the husbandman, the preacher and his followers, and the pioneering woman. And this is true, hummable Americana, as the State Department representative said. But she also brought very important messages, such as the ability to seduce the hearts and minds of mankind, which was part of the Cold War agenda, to bring everyone over to the Western side, the democratic free way of thinking. And with that, she brought work such as Diversion of Angels, which I've spoken about, which talks about human essential emotions, love, lamentation, her work about grief, and then also an argument about the sophistication of the United States with her works based on Greek myth, and particularly Clytemnestra or Medea or Jocasta, the story of Oedipus. So she brought, as one person said of Martha Graham, she brought this smorgasbord to the State Department, and then they could pick and choose which works would work in each of the different locations, depending on what messages needed to get put forward. And I believe that it is her fundamental belief in freedom and the freedom of the mind and some essential human emotions that made her so valuable.
Where was her stance politically? Because here she is, you know, trying to espouse American freedom, you know, being put forth as espousing American freedoms and winning other countries over to the Western side, as you just described, yet she disavows political attachments. How was that reconciled?
Well, I think that to me this was the most fascinating part of the study, was that she said, my work is not political. Indeed, when I was at the school in 1979 and the company left for what was known as the Jimmy Carter Goodwill Tour as a part of the Camp David Accords to Egypt, Israel, and Amman, that was very much at the forefront. This is not, my work is not political. And indeed, you know, looking at some very essential things for our country right now, such as race, she had core beliefs that were useful to the United States government from Roosevelt and every single president through Bush, every administration, higher taxes, lower taxes, Social Security, no Social Security, whatever it was this essential belief in freedom and mankind. And in that, she believed very strongly that that she looked at a person and a dancer and the shape of their eyes, the color of their skin, made no difference whatsoever to her. So, and she took an active stance that way. During the interwar, when there were anti-Semitic quotas, even in the United States, she hired Jewish dancers and then refused to go to Nazi Germany to perform in the Olympics, which would have been a huge coup at that point in time. She hired Yuriko out of an internment camp in 1941 and traveled the United States with a Japanese dancer as the United States was interning Japanese people. In 1951, she hired Mary Hinkson and Matt Tierney and became the first person to hire African-American dancers into a mainstream modern company, tour and perform on Broadway. So she had core American beliefs that were sometimes quite far ahead of her time, but then also became useful as political statements and, in a sense, propaganda on these tours.
Where do you think her most important work was done, under which president, and why?
That's a fascinating question, Allison. Of course, her first experience with the presidency would be extremely significant for her, and that was the Roosevelts. Eleanor Roosevelt, I like to think of Eleanor Roosevelt as the Oprah of her time. She had syndicated columns, she had a radio show, and she was very involved in the arts and promoting the arts to the populace through Works Progress Administration programs and the like. And Eleanor Roosevelt liked Martha Graham and brought her to the White House to perform Frontier, the story of a pioneering woman, and also asked her to do some wonderful performances for the World's Fair. So that, of course, was a very significant relationship because it put Graham really on the map in 1937. And as we can imagine, then when she goes to work with Barbara Bush as late as 1989, that relationship with the White House has spanned Betty Ford, Jackie Onassis, and numerous others. So I would say certainly the Roosevelt administration was the most important as the founding relationship. And then Jackie Onassis, who then also edited her autobiography, and Betty Ford, who was a huge influence on Martha Graham in terms of the promotion, and Barbara Bush.
I just wanted to dive a little deeper into gender, because you just mentioned all the first ladies, or most of the first ladies, you know, for the presidents that she danced abroad. For relations, diplomatic relations. What was the relationship with the first ladies, and how important was that relationship as opposed to with the president?
That's a really interesting question, and I was fascinated because my first response as a historian after seeing the relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt was to trace the first ladies. And indeed, that didn't work very well because Bess Truman, Mamie Eisenhower, really didn't have much interest in Graham at all, as far as I could see. Lady Bird Johnson did. Jackie Kennedy Onassis was smitten with Graham, and not only helped clearly with a tour in 1962, but then did a lot of fundraising, sat on the board for a while, and at Doubleday became the editor of Graham's autobiography that was published in 1991. So there was a long-term relationship there. Under Reagan, I found pictures of Graham's letters between Reagan and his letters back to her. You know, bless you, Martha, bless you, Ronnie. And there is no indication that Nancy had much tolerance for this at all. And Barbara Bush, the opposite. Barbara and Martha seemed to be having a lovely time together with their letters, playing with the dogs in the White House. And I think the president did not have as much interest in her. And this is one of Martha Graham's geniuses, is she knows exactly who to go to within administration. So she said she never worked with the Nixon administration, but she did work with Kissinger.
Interesting, yeah.
She was really good.
Dance wasn't her only strong suit. Let's
That's
just put
correct.
It that way, right? And then, you know, I'm thinking too, were there any of the first ladies that changed something, I don't know, about maybe the kind of dance she would perform or her view when she was going abroad? Was there any who had the most profound effect on her? And I can guess who you'll say.
Well, you know, I would think first, obviously, Eleanor Roosevelt, who I've spoken about. And then I think some of the Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge and Bezabita Rothschild, in terms of women who ran foundations and funded her works, were extremely influential in molding how she was presented. I think Bezabita Rothschild would be the most influential. Interestingly, in terms of the first ladies, I would go to Jackie Kennedy Onassis, for sure, but in terms of the depth of the relationship, I would go to Betty Ford. And there they had a personal relationship and interestingly revolved around alcohol and drug addiction. And both of them wrestled with that problem and were triumphant, which is statistically not the norm.
Right, which obviously strengthens that bond all the more. You know, we're talking about the presidents and first ladies and dignitaries and all of that. What about kind of the war between women, in the sense that Martha Graham's going abroad, and then, you know, there's Russian ballerinas there, you know, in these countries where the press is making them out to be, you know, dance wars between the two. Was that going on, or was that just in the headlines? What was the personal gain or personal, like, I have to be better than her?
I think when it comes to the ballerina wars, in a sense, it was an apples to oranges fight. So when she first landed in 1955 in Japan, and it was the Russian ballerina versus Martha, I don't think she was really comparing how high the leg went or anything of that nature. She even went as far as to say that she uses ballet, and in a sense, she made it better. She modernized it. And indeed, later on, her dancers had very strong balletic lines that could compete. And indeed, there were contests where her dancers could do tilts. So stand on one leg and tilt over in a 180-degree split. And ballerinas could not do that. So there was, you know, there was a competition for sure, but it was known as an apples to oranges fight.
Interesting. What about, let's fast forward to today. And do we have any equivalent of the exportation in perhaps a more subtle way of the arts? And then what might Martha Graham feature choreography-wise to counter what's happening in Russia today?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, and one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was that unfortunately, I don't believe there's enough happening in terms of using the arts as diplomacy. It's a wonderful opportunity. Dance and music are both, you don't need language. You don't need to speak German or English or Chinese to understand the beauty and the elegance of movement. I think we saw that very clearly with some of the Chinese spectacles, the Olympics and their dance companies. There is a sense of awe and brilliance that can be communicated cross-culturally without language. And I do wish our government would support more of that. Since the Cold War, really, these efforts have been curtailed extremely significantly. Alvin Ailey right now is really the only company that goes out, as far as I know, smaller companies, Battery Dance and the like. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity in the future as we are renegotiating and bridging with other countries to do new efforts in dance.
And then what choreography might work today?
That's a really interesting question. You know, as Martha said, my dance is not modern, it is contemporary. And she was always looking for the newest way to express things. She would go for an essence, perhaps in COVID, a look at mortality a sense of disease. But she always wanted to end on a high note. She never wanted to end on a low note. And I think she would use film and Zoom and Google and whatever new resource there was. For example, you know, she did works about the Temple of Dendur when the Temple of Dendur was opening at the Metropolitan Museum. So she was always of her time, and I think she'd be using that right now.
When did this U.S. export of dance, of Martha Graham in particular, end?
It ended firmly with the presidency of George Bush and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Martha Graham, under Barbara Bush and George Bush the first, the father, was slated to go to the Soviet bloc countries, Russia and Moscow, in 1989, and she was supposed to go in November. Interestingly, the Berlin Wall fell in November. I believe that George Bush understood that there were revolutions going on and pulled her back. She had a heavy schedule of Americana, very heavily pro-American works, which didn't really need to be said anymore. That was 1989, and then, of course, she died in 1991 with the end of the Cold War, and that was the end. That last planned tour was the last government tour for the Graham Company.
What would she want her legacy to be, and what is it, and are they the same?
She wanted her legacy to be that of a performer, of a dancer. And unfortunately, the only tapes we have are of her when she is well into her 50s, for the most part. There are some tapes of her, early tapes of her. But as we know, dance doesn't really translate onto film. My sense is that her legacy is that of a revolutionary genius, someone who could look at human movement and distill something very distinct out of it that will move an audience. Works like Lamentation, that speaks to the depths of lament that a human being will feel, the way one weeps, the way one moves when one weeps or laughs. That's what she could capture.
If there's anything else you wanted to highlight before maybe we talk about Beirut, please feel free to highlight them if there's anything you wanted to talk about there. I know there's a lot. That's why you wrote a book. But, but you know, if there's something particularly salient or anything like that, please.
I think one of the key aspects of her success was her ability to make connections with other women. And this is something that is a forgotten part of her legacy. She very famously not only said, "My work is not political," she said, "I am not a liberationist," and disavowed any connections to the feminist movement, which is fascinating. She was a woman who was center stage, ran the company, was the star, she was the fundraiser, she was the choreographer. So that she would disavow feminism, of course, is fascinating. Then she also used these links with women, funders, Lila Acheson Wallace, the Reader's Digest Foundation, Bezabita Rothschild, Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge, then the sister of the Dulles brothers, Eleanor Lansing Dulles, the subject of my next book, Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Ladies. She had this incredible network of women who she relied on, Bezabita Rothschild, Betty Ford. And it was this kind of this use of this underground, powerful network of women that was so vital to her success.
I'm so glad you brought that up for obvious reasons. and then you just mentioned it. Let's, you know, are you focusing on the subject of your next book as you are?
My next book is about Eleanor Lansing Dulles, who is the subject of Chapter 3 in the Martha Graham book. She was the sister of John Foster, the Secretary of State under Eisenhower, and Allen, the head of the director of the CIA under Eisenhower, and then released by Kennedy with the Bay of Pigs. It's a family of missionaries and Secretary of States. And there were five siblings, the two brothers, very well known, and Eleanor, who has been overlooked by historians. She got her PhD from Harvard in economics in 1927 and went to work in the State Department before her brother. So I follow her to Austria and divided Berlin between 1945 and 1961 for a grand tale of rebuilding and psychological warfare, kidnappings, and the like.
Excellent. Thank you for highlighting yet another woman overlooked in the pages of history. There are many. Now, you mentioned, you know, you have a lot of dancer friends in Beirut where there was that horrible explosion recently. And what's going on with them there? What's been the response?
When I heard about what happened in Beirut, my first thought was for the dancers I interviewed there. The 1979 Jimmy Carter Goodwill Tour took the Martha Graham Dance Company to Egypt and Israel, which is a fascinating part of the story. She was one of the first people to cross the border, and literally her sets and costumes had to be driven through the desert and handed across a border, Israeli to Egyptian, Egyptian to Israeli. An amazing moment in history that brought on a cultural agreement, again, a forgotten agreement that included archaeology, anthropology, science, medicine, and the like, and Martha Graham. And again, this is where one of the things that's forgotten is how the dance is just one piece of many diplomatic exchanges. In order to find out what happened in Amman, I ended up in Lebanon interviewing dancers who had been sent from Lebanon in the midst of a civil war to Amman to learn the dance technique. There were some very nice, strong modern dance studios in Beirut. And indeed, all of the information I got on Amman was from these dancers who literally went under their bed to find the reviews, to find the tapes of this momentous occasion in 1979. So, of course, as I recalled being with them in their apartment, speaking with them about the troubles in Lebanon, the civil wars that had racked them, the inspiration that they gained from Martha Graham and her work, I thought of their window shattering. they described hiding in their dance studios and feeling, you know, understanding that bullets were rattling the walls around them. And here they were again under attack. My sense from them is the deepest form of disappointment and pride in Lebanon and the beauty of Beirut, and deep disappointment, and also a desire for restitution and revenge.
My question to her about Beirut stemmed from the deadly Beirut port explosion August 4th. And that was Cold War historian Victoria Phillips, who also specializes in cultural diplomacy and international relations. She was talking about her book, Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. Phillips has curated several exhibits on dance and politics in Europe and Washington, D.C. She has lectured at renowned universities, colleges, high schools, and international institutes. Her primary research is held at the Library of Congress as the Victoria Phillips Collection. Before her academic career, Phillips was a dancer and then a portfolio manager on Wall Street.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Marty Moscoane. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress. Women like Mary Church Terrell, who was born during the Civil War right after the Emancipation Proclamation. The daughter of former enslaved people, she grew up in a household where education was important. In 1892, a friend's lynching strengthened her struggle for African American and women's rights. She went on to co-found the NAACP in 1909 with W.E.B. Du Bois and others. Her autobiography, A Colored Woman in a White World, was published in 1940. In her 80s, Mary Church Terrell won a lawsuit against a whites-only restaurant, helping to end the Jim Crow laws. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1626.